Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a Homeland Security funding fight, deep U.S.-Israel tension, ISIS, CPAC. National Security Advisor Susan Rice warned of a new and destructive partisanship around U.S. ties with Israel.
Which is not only unfortunate, it's destructive of the fabric of the relationship.
Congress down to the wire in a fight over immigration and homeland security funding. Here's DHS Secretary Jay Johnson.
I've spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill talking to Democrats, Republicans, about how critical it is in these challenging times in particular that we have a budget for homeland security.
And the ISIS knife wielder, so-called Jihadi John, identified as British national Mohammed Emwazi. Here he was in September.
Just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the necks of your people.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Meredith Shiner of Yahoo News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on What's Your Top Story This Week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post, author of many books, including last year's novel, The Director. He's just back from Iraq, Jordan, and Israel. David Ignatius, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Washington, Meredith Shiner joins us, political reporter for Yahoo News. Meredith, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty is here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Meredith.
Meredith, as we speak, and this could change before some of our listeners hear this wrap-up of the week's news, where does the funding for the Department of Homeland Security stand in Congress? Are they coming up with a three-week stopgap here? What's the prospect?
So this morning, as we speak, the Senate is voting to open debate on their version of the Homeland Security funding bill. Conservatives are actually letting this vote happen, which is a rare turn of events that we haven't seen previously from some of these conservatives like Ted Cruz or Mike Lee. But there's still a question of what the House can do. And you're right that they're considering a three-week stopgap measure. And the reason that that's happening is because there was an order from a district judge in Texas basically halting this latest executive action from the president on immigration. And so Republican leaders on the House side, they think that they can buy themselves some time by saying, hey, we don't have to shut down this department over stopping an order that a judge has already stopped. So they basically have the deadline of today to come up with something. But Senate Democrats have been very loath to only patch this for 3 weeks. So I think that the outcome of this is still a bit up in the air.
And House Republicans very, very loath to give a sign off on this. This was back on Wednesday. Representative Matt Salmon, Republican Arizona, said he would not vote for any bill that funded the Department of Homeland Security a clean bill and left the immigration executive order of President Obama intact.
If the speaker brought a vote to the floor, it was just a clean vote on DHS that funded what I believe an unconstitutional action. I'm not going to be part of funding something I believe is unconstitutional. I believe that's a dereliction of my oath of office, and I'm not going to be part of that.
The president went straight to Miami, sort of the heart of the capital of Hispanic culture in the U.S. right now, maybe, to make a lot of this. Here he is talking in Miami on Wednesday, talking about the impasse over the funding of the Department of Homeland Security and the immigration issue.
What we said to Republicans is instead of trying to hold hostage funding for the Department of Homeland Security, which is so important for our national security, fund that. And let's get on with actually passing comprehensive immigration reform.
David Ignatius, it's a domestic issue, but it's got lines all over the place in terms of all the immigrants who have come and may come. In terms of American security, homeland security, and the operations of this big department, what do you make of this pileup yet again over funding here and these issues, David?
Well, I think this flap illustrates the dilemma of the Republicans. They, especially conservative House members, want to appeal to their base. They have campaigned against stopping, reversing what they see as Obama's illegal executive actions on immigration involving DHS. At the same time, they want to be seen as a responsible party that can govern America. The idea of cutting off funding for the Department of Homeland Security at a time of unusually high concern in the U.S. and around the world about terrorism is going to strike the average voter as crazy. And so the Republicans are really are caught in this dilemma. They go right up the edge of the cliff, and then they think, gosh, we really don't want to jump off. And that's what we're seeing this morning, I think, some kind of stopgap measure. But at the end of the day, I think this illustrates again the difficulty John Boehner has in legislating with a House Republican caucus that cares less about legislating than it does making points in this partisan debate.
Jack Beatty, step back and look at this. It's a debate about immigration. It's a debate about executive authority. And it's come down to a debate about funding on Homeland Security's front. What do you see?
Well, you know, to pick up on David's point about the cliff, Peter King, the Long Island Democrat, says, how many times can we go over the cliff and survive? He means survive politically. With polls showing by 53-30, the public would blame the GOP for any shutdown. King has a point.
And isn't he a Republican? You mean the Republican Peter King, Jack?
Peter King is indeed a Republican.
Okay.
And the strangest thing about this is that even if the bill the House GOP wanted passed the Senate, the president would veto it. So the whole exercise is, well, it's the sort of same shambolic symbolism we saw in 2013. Then the Republicans wanted to shut down the whole government over ending funding for Obamacare, which the president would never have signed. So that was a destructive exercise purely. It cost billions. It did the Republican Party no good. And they were only saved from what could have been a very damaging, blot on their escutcheon by the president's, the mess up of the rollout of the Obamacare. And so here they're back into it again. I suppose we should be grateful that they're not trying to shut down the whole government this time, but it certainly underlines the point that David's making. They can't seem to find their way to being a governing party.
Funding running out at midnight tonight for the Department of Homeland Security. By the time you hear this wrap-up of the week's news, there may be a three-week stopgap in effect. That's being kicked around right now in Washington. David Ignatius, take us to these arrests in New York this week. A couple of Americans allegedly headed to join ISIS in the Middle East, and a third who is charged with supporting them in that. Is this part of the security threat that Jay Johnson's talking about when he says this is no time to cut funding for my department?
It's a perfect example. These three appear to have been radicalized on the internet. The FBI was sending in people to were monitoring them, in a sense provoking them, and also monitoring their communications. Interestingly, these three are from Central Asia. I believe there are two Uzbeks and one Kazakh who were arrested in Brooklyn. That interests me because when I was in Iraq now 10 days ago, mm-hmm. traveling with the Kurdish Peshmerga, I was told that their radio intercepts of ISIS fighters who were doing the heaviest fighting now in the area outside of Mosul are picking up Central Asian accents. They're picking up Uzbeks, Kazakhs, Turkmen. So the draw for people from that part of the world into this jihadist fight is powerful. Some of the things that the FBI surveilled were on Uzbek language websites that they were monitoring. One of these people was actually arrested as he was on his way to JFK Airport. So that shows that this was caught in time. There's one touching, I don't know if touching is the right word, but One of the would-be jihadists was worried that he wouldn't be able to get his passport back from his mother before he went off to fight against the Crusaders. So it's an example that in the U.S. there are people who are being radicalized, that the FBI, as FBI Director Comey said, it has investigations going now on homegrown terrorists like these three are alleged to be in all 50 states. So that tells you that this problem is really out there.
Here's the New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton. This was on Wednesday, talking about the three arrests and the danger at home and washing back home.
So this is real. This is the concern about the lone wolf inspired to act without ever going to the Middle East, or the concern of once they get to the Middle East, acquire fighting skills, capabilities, and then attempting to return to the country.
Of course, monitoring or provoking, as you said, sort of sotto voice there, David Ignatius. I don't know all the detail there, but there's a concern about that as well. Here's Linda Sarsour, Executive Director of the Arab American Association of New York, talking with WNYC on Thursday, worried about the relationship between her community and law enforcement.
People get worried and start believing that, you know, these types of arrests justify, you know, broad-based surveillance programs. They justify government policies that target American Muslims. People get worried, you know, to have to confront or defend our community. And it sends a really, you know, interesting, you know, kind of message to young people.
Jack, there's a balance here, a balance in Washington on funding in the first place for the Department of Homeland Security, but also a balance in terms of law enforcement, what's monitoring, what's provocation, and not alienating the very communities that clearly the country needs on board.
Yes, and that dynamic of alienating the people, well, a potential terrorist, is one of the scenarios people are using about the jihadi John in Britain. He complained in a 2010 email that he was being held up from going, from marrying, from working. He couldn't get out of it. He was a prisoner in London. The British wouldn't give him a visa. He was fed up. Well, I don't know if that...
Well, write a letter, I say. Don't behead people in the
desert.
Yes,
right. But that may be a case where, you know, the British were just monitoring him just enough to infuriate him, but not enough to restrain him. And that, again, gets to the root of it. I mean, we can't have preventive detention, and yet on the other hand, if these people just keep going over there, something will have to be done.
You don't want to hear American accents in those radio transmissions that David Ignatius was hearing about. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Looking at a week in the news, Homeland Security funding mess, a U.S.-Israel rift, net neutrality, Jihadi John, CPAC in Washington, or just outside Washington this week, and more. Meredith Shiner is with us, political reporter for Yahoo News. David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post, just back from the Middle East. Jack Beatty's here. David, I have to ask you just a little more. On the Jihadi John ID front, we're told that British intelligence identified him some time ago. How much confidence do you have in this identification? What about the heat they're taking at this point for not somehow going in and getting him, David?
This seems similar to the kind of assessment that was done after the fact, after the French attacks of the Kouachi brothers and then the attack on the kosher market, where it turned out that the Kouachis had been under surveillance by the French. They indeed had been wiretapped, but that the evidence had been insufficient to continue those wiretaps. Similarly with the British, they had their eye on Mr. Mohammed Emwazi, who's turns out to be the real name of Jihadi John. Indeed, MI5 called him in for questioning, according to one account, tried to recruit him as an agent. And as Jack said earlier, it's just possible that counterterrorist surveillance may have been a part of the process of radicalization of this computer science graduate from a British university, someone who did not have the profile of a desperate knife wielding terrorist at the beginning of the story. I think for all of the European countries and for the U.S. too, this illustrates what a delicate process it will be to follow people who are being recruited on the internet invisibly, who may surface in some way, but you have to be careful that in assessing who they are, following them, getting information, you don't make the problem worse, make Muslims feel they're under special scrutiny, make people like Emwazi feel that they have a reason to go into violent jihad where before they were just perhaps disaffected members of their communities.
I want to ask in particular about what we've seen out of ISIS this week, the unbelievable destruction of ancient cultural treasures in Syria and beyond, and this attack on the Assyrian Christians of northeastern Syria. Villages just rolled over by ISIS. There are hundreds taken prisoners, others reportedly kept as slaves. The New York Times says it looks like a rampage out of the time of Tamerlane or Genghis Khan. Assyrian Christians, one of the world's oldest Christian communities, speaking a modern version of Aramaic, the language of Jesus. The destruction here looks terrible, David. ISIS just not tolerant, whether it's statues or people, anything that's not in their narrow definition of the way the world ought to be within their caliphate, as they call it.
The destruction of these beautiful art objects was as horrifying in a different way, just as burning a pilot alive, decapitating 21 kneeling Coptic Christians on a beach in Libya have been. I commend to your listeners an article that has just appeared in The Atlantic. I believe the author is named Graham Wood. But he argues, based on extensive research, that we have to understand that the people who are drawn to this jihadist movement are taking these actions out of what they see in a very literal reading as the instructions from the days of the prophet, the days of the prophet, the noble ancestors. And indeed, they find references in Scripture to beheading, crucifixion, making non-Muslims slaves where possible, killing apostate Muslims. And the point that this article makes is that it's not simple, you know, brutality, wanton desire for these super violent images, but people thinking that they're returning to the kind of war, the forms of warfare that they read about. And obviously there are many Muslim scholars who argue that that's nonsense. But the article's worth a note just in getting a little bit into the mindset of this group.
Compelling piece. Lots of pushback from Muslims and others saying this is a sort of super violent misreading. You can look in the Bible and find recipes for genocide. But does that mean that?
Absolutely. And I should say that the leading Sunni cleric in the world, the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, said in Mecca last week that these Islamic State terrorists are pushing a corrupt misinterpretation of Islam. I don't in any way mean to say that their interpretation is correct. It's just that the article argues that this is how they think they're grounded.
Meanwhile, Assyrian Christians really in trouble. Here's Osama Edward, founder of the Assyrian Human Rights Network, nephew of one of those kidnapped, of the many kidnapped by ISIS this week, in an interview with CNN on Wednesday.
Seeing what ISIS done for the Egyptian Christians in Libya and the Iraqi Christians and the Iraqi Assyrians, I don't think I'm going to be realistic, and even I hope for better, but I guess maybe they're facing the same destiny.
The same destiny would not be good. Sounds like death. Meredith Shiner, I just wonder again how this plays with the toughest Republicans or the hardest line Republicans in Washington in this Homeland Security debate, with these arrests in Brooklyn and all the rest. Do they not believe that the Department of Homeland Security would be handicapped by a funding cutoff? They think enough people will still be at work that it's not a security issue? Or they just, come hell or high water, the immigration and executive powers issues are more important to them, Meredith?
So I have two thoughts on this. The first is going back to the first segment and what Jack and David said about, you know, the tension that Republicans are feeling and trying to prove that they can govern. I think one of the reasons why this conversation is more interesting than the one we had in 2013 about the overall government is because part of the ethos of the Republican Party for the past few years, whether it's right or it's wrong, is that they're the party that's strong on national security. So I think that they're feeling greater pressure about this because it's right in what they've tried to make their policy wheelhouse. But the second question is looking at this through a more complicated policy frame. I think that ultimately the Department of Homeland Security will get funded. I think the greater issue that's relevant to all of these incidents that are happening internationally is the authorization of use of military force debate that's happening in Congress. The White House has sent language for what they would like Congress to enable them to do. And which is actually a bit of a fool's errand anyway, because I think that they think they can do whatever they want no matter what. But one of the debates you're seeing in Congress is, what exactly are we fighting? Who are we fighting? Should there be a deadline for this particular fight against ISIS? And is it mandatory to basically sunset the pre-existing AUMF, which dates back to the Iraq War and Afghanistan, before we move forward on this? Because the current draft of the legislation from the White House does not get rid of that previous blank check to the administration to basically, you know, engage militarily anywhere that it wants. So this particular question of what do we do against ISIS and where is this fight being waged, I think that that's very central to the policy battle on the AUMF and secondary, in a sense, on the DHS fight, because ultimately that will be resolved.
Meanwhile, right alongside all this, you've got this huge tension. I can't recall anything quite like it between the United States or the Obama administration and the government of Israel right now. Just crackling. Susan Rice looking at how partisanship has come into this. Of course, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu will speak to Congress next week. Which people in Congress will show up for that is still an open question. Democrats invited him to come and speak to them separately. He declined. You could cut the tension here with a knife. It's all about negotiations with Iran over their nuclear program. Here was Secretary of State John Kerry in front of the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Wednesday talking about the deal with Iran, the U.S. sitting down and trying to make something happen.
On Iran, we've taken the risk of sitting down, of trying to figure out, is there a diplomatic path to solve this problem? I can't sit here today and tell you I know the answer to that. But I can tell you it's worth trying before you go to more extreme measures that may result in asking young Americans yet again to put themselves in harm's way.
And the assumption there is that he's talking about war as a potential outcome if we can't work out some negotiated settlement on this with Iran. Yesterday, Speaker of the House John Boehner defended his invitation to the Israeli Prime Minister to speak in front of Congress, sidestepped the White House, blindsided them with him with this. He talked about against the administration's nuclear talks with Iran. John Boehner.
But what is destructive, in my view, is making a bad deal that paves the way for a nuclear Iran. That's destructive, and that's why it's so important for the American people to hear what Prime Minister Netanyahu has to say about the grave threats that we're facing. So I'm glad the Prime Minister is coming.
And here's Democrat Dick Durbin from Illinois, Senate Minority Whip, a big backer of Israel by and large, but here criticizing the Israeli Prime Minister.
He is double-downing on the Boehner invitation. I had hoped that he would acknowledge that this has become politically divisive and that he would at least meet with us, but he decided not to.
David Ignatius, can you recall a worse, more fraught time in U.S.-Israel relations?
I can't, and I, having just come back from Israel, I would say that this issue of the way in which Prime Minister Netanyahu seems to Israelis to have allied with one political party in the U.S., the Republicans, has caused considerable concern. The Israeli elections are March 17, 2 weeks after he gives his speech. And I think the speech and the politics surrounding it will be a big issue. What Israelis fear is that the United States, which is their crucial go-to ally, has always been an ally on a bipartisan basis. Both Republicans and Democrats have embraced the idea that Israel matters, Israeli security is crucial. And this is an unusual instance in which an Israeli prime minister in effect works with one party, not the party in the White House, to make his arguments because he so mistrusts the sitting president. Democrats who were supportive of Israel tried to get Netanyahu to climb back from that and have a private meeting with House and Senate Democrats who've been longtime supporters of Israel. And Netanyahu refused to do that in the last several days. And that, I think, further deepened the split here and also the anxiety in Israel. So it is going to be a big political issue in their elections, and how Netanyahu gives this speech, the extent to which he is seen as being partisan in the speech and making the divide even worse, will be one of the key issues.
Meredith Shiner, what's being anticipated about turnout for the Prime Minister's speech next week? Are people on record now? Who's coming? Who's not?
Yeah. So about 25 House Democrats have already said that they won't attend. Four United States senators, including Tim Kaine of Virginia, Patrick Leahy of Vermont, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and Brian Schatz of Hawaii, have said that they're going to take a pass. I think that you could see a few more defections in the days to come. But I learned something very interesting this week, which is that whenever there's a joint speech to Congress, which happens every year for State of the Union, for foreign leaders, it's happened 25 times since 2000, including a 2011 address by Prime Minister Netanyahu himself, they have to add more chairs to the House floor because you have senators who are coming over, you have more people. The Speaker has to order that. So it's entirely possible that they could just make sure that there are fewer chairs on the House floor so it doesn't look like there are empty seats, which seems like a very incremental optics sort of move. But it could be important because David is right. This has become very divisive here in terms of having Israeli politics be partisan. I remember Netanyahu's speech in 2011. It was an extraordinarily hawkish speech. And you would have thought that some of the things that he said would have rubbed Democrats the wrong way, given their overall foreign policy tack. But I think that they were so aligned with Israel. I think that AIPAC is so important here in terms of the money that they contribute to campaigns, that you saw so many bipartisan rounds of applause. And you don't even see that for our own president. I think that there was a lot of pull that Netanyahu had, and that you have so many people openly saying they won't attend the speech, I think is a symbol of how far he's fallen in standing here, at least with one party.
David Ignatius, we're going to spend a full hour on this on Monday, on the eve of the Netanyahu speech, the relationship and the negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program. But can you just take us to the heart of the split here between the White House and Netanyahu over those negotiations? What does the White House see as possible and desirable? What does Netanyahu see as, I guess, utterly unacceptable?
Let me try to reconstruct this as I've done through my reporting and what I've published. On the 12th of January, just over a month ago, Prime Minister Netanyahu called President Obama to talk about the Iran nuclear talks. President Obama asked for a couple more months to see if he could pin down the deal that he and Secretary Kerry had been trying to get, which appears to be pretty close. And Netanyahu, I'm told, said no. From what I know about the concessions you've already made in terms of the number of centrifuges that Iran will be allowed, the extent to which Iran will be able to enrich uranium under this deal, I've concluded it's a bad deal no matter what, and I'm going to oppose it every way I can. That was the 12th of January. On the 17th of January, the Boehner invitation to Netanyahu to speak came. And according to administration officials, by the end of January, leaks were appearing in the Israeli press, which they attribute to the Prime Minister's office, about very sensitive details of the U.S. negotiating position, which the Israelis, which Netanyahu opposes. So you had a kind of unusual break out from the very secret, confidential discussions between heads of government into this more open public lobbying. I mean, in a sense, Netanyahu's speech on March 3rd will be a foreign leader coming to our Congress to lobby Congress on behalf of what he thinks is the right position. So there's a lot of talk about personality, and the personality split between Netanyahu and Obama has been obvious from their first meeting. It's about a lot more than that. The Israelis fundamentally feel that Obama has made so many concessions that this is a deal that will make Iran a nuclear threshold state. It won't have a bomb, but it will be a year from being able to make a bomb, and they think that's dangerous.
Jack Beatty, same question for you. Do you recall ever such a fraught time in this relationship before?
Well, I don't really. I mean, there certainly have been some time. I remember when I was a kid, President Eisenhower basically telling the Israelis to get out of Sinai along with the British and the French. So we've had confrontations. But when an Israeli, former national Israeli security advisor says it's never been so terrible as today, the relationship, that has to be given credence.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel will face a runoff April 7th in his reelection bid against Jesus Chuy Garcia in Chicago. Garcia was jubilant on election night.
Well, we're still standing. We're still running. And we're going to win.
A Texas jury convicted Eddie Ray Roth of killing American sniper Chris Kyle and friend Chad Littlefield. Judy Littlefield, Chad's mother, said she was grateful justice was done.
We've waited 2 years for God to get justice for us on behalf of our son. And as always, God has proved to be faithful.
Birdman won Best Picture at the Oscars on Sunday, and Best Supporting Actress winner for her role in Boyhood, Patricia Arquette, called for equal pay for women.
It's our time to have wage equality once and for all, and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
We're looking at a week in the news, Homeland Security funding mess, U.S.-Israel rift, net neutrality, Jihadi John CPAC outside of D.C. there. We'll look at that. Meredith Shiner is here from Yahoo News, David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post, and Jack Beatty. Let's go to our phones. Sumner in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Sumner, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm not a big Netanyahu fan, but I think it's vital for him to speak. A couple of things happened this week about the same time that John Kerry was giving his testimony before the Senate that were not reported by NPR or most of the American news media.
What have you got there, Sumner?
Number one, a full-scale model of full-scale mock-up of the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier was destroyed by cruise missiles in Iran. That was coupled with the head of the Iranian military saying that they would destroy American ships in the Persian Gulf and that they would possibly attack the United States if the United States were to retaliate or were to get involved in a fight with them. The second thing was that was also unreported for the most part was that there was a disclosure that there was yet another hidden Iranian nuclear site unknown to the IAEA, which has been discovered northeast of Tehran. Now, the Obama policy or negotiations have failed to even address the issue of Iran's ICBMs and intermediate missiles. So it's vital that he be heard.
You know, Sumner, I hear where you're coming from. I don't know about the details of what you're conveying right there. On the other hand, how do you put this in context of the U.S. Secretary of State saying this is our best shot to avoid American guys going off to war? We think this is reasonable and good and the best thing we ought to do. And the White House backing him on that, and a foreign head of state coming in without even telling them to address Congress. Don't we have our elected reps who are supposed to have our interests in mind here?
Well, we do, but on the other hand, these negotiations started a year and a half ago, just about, with the idea that we were going to eliminate Iran's stockpile, that it was going to be shipped out of the country, and that they were going to have very, very, very limited capacity to refine uranium.
And that Sumner, we've got it, and that's not where they're headed right now. There are going to be a lot more centrifuges, thousands, as David Ignatius says, under this deal if it comes to pass. Sumner, let me hold that and get one more call. Fairfield, Connecticut. Ed, you're on.
Hi. I want to try to be concise. Interestingly, I have in the seat beside me the Atlantic article by Graham Wood, which I did just finish. ISIL movement is medieval in its thoughts and practices, and they need to be stopped. Having said that, we've had much less tension between the United States and Iran than we've had of late with other players, Iraq, Afghanistan. I think going forward with negotiations is with Iran is perfectly acceptable. It's moving forward. More important to me is that Mr. Netanyahu seems to think that he has some sort of special privilege. This is a case of a very small tail trying to wag a very large dog. And what I'm trying to say here is that if Mr. Netanyahu feels that more needs to be done, then perhaps he should send his fighter jets and his military personnel into Iraq or into Iran to do what he feels he needs to do. But the last thing that the United States needs now is to continue the state of war that we've been in since we went into Iraq.
Ed, we've got it. Let me take it right there, if I may. David Ignatius, am I right in interpreting John Kerry as saying in those remarks you played earlier that they think they've got the best deal they can get and it's an alternative to war, which may be on the table if they don't get a negotiated deal?
Well, I think you basically got Kerry right. If the talks collapse without a deal, it's almost a certainty that Congress will respond by enacting additional sanctions. And if that happens, I think it's likely that Iran will move back to an aggressive program of enrichment using the latest generation centrifuges that it has, a program that it's effectively halted since the negotiations began. And at that point, the U.S. and Israel are presented with a very difficult choice. Do you take military action in some form or another to stop that program, stop that movement by Iran towards having a nuclear weapon, or not? And I think Kerry's point is this is our best alternative to unpalatable choices. I do think that everyone's going to have to look at the details of this agreement when they're finally announced, if they get there, and make a judgment, having listened to Netanyahu, having listened to Secretary Kerry, the president. Is this a deal that on balance provides greater safety and security for everybody, but especially for the United States, than the alternatives? Is there a realistic alternative that would be better? And I think everybody, we only have a few weeks to wait, but people should, I think, hold off on making judgments in the end until they see the deal.
We're going to talk a lot more about this on Monday. Let me get Amy in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Amy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to hear what your guests have to say about Scott Walker's comments at CPAC yesterday, kind of painting the protesters that marched on Madison to ISIS terrorists. And since he dealt with those protesters, he's completely capable of dealing with terrorists abroad. Regardless of political party, I think painting anyone that is using their First Amendment rights in this country is sickening. And I'm just amazed that I haven't heard more comments about this. Obviously, here in Wisconsin, people are going crazy about it.
Amy, let us turn to it right here. You're going back to when Scott Walker put the hammer down on collective bargaining for public unions in Wisconsin. He won that fight, though thousands and thousands turned out to protest at the State House there in Madison, Wisconsin. And yes, he was at the Conservative Political Action Conference this week, CPAC, and he used his handling of those protests as he talked about what he wanted in a commander-in-chief, maybe himself, dealing with ISIS. Here's Scott Walker at CPAC.
I want a commander-in-chief who will do everything in their power to ensure that the threat from radical Islamic terrorists do not wash up in American soil. We will have someone who leads and ultimately will send a message not only that we will protect American soil, but do not take this upon freedom-loving people anywhere else in the world. We need a leader with that kind of confidence. If I can take on 100,000 protesters, I can do the same across the world.
Jack Beatty, Scott Walker there at CPAC. If I can take on American citizens in their seat of government in an American state, I can take on ISIS or anybody in the world? What?
His people have walked that back. Of course, they also point out he did get death threats. His family did as well. But they have walked that back and said, of course, he's not creating an equivalence. But that goes over very well with the audience he's dealing with, as did his nescience or his noncommittal in London on the question of evolution. Oh, I don't want to get... As did his calculated comment, I don't really know, basically saying he didn't know whether the president was a Christian or not, as did his refusal to make any judgment on the merits of Rudy Giuliani's smear of the president. All of these things, which look, you know, terrible from some objective political standpoint, are catnip for the audience he's dealing with. And one of the crucial questions for Republican candidates in this very crowded field is, how far do you go to pander? And I think we've seen with him there isn't a limit to how far he's willing to go. We're going to see how Jeb Bush has to deal with that. His whole pitch is, I won't go there. I'm going to run even in the primaries like a general election candidate. Let's see if that happens.
More moderate. Meredith Shiner, what's your sense of who's doing well with the conservatives who are assembled here, who do tend to make up a lot of primary base voters for the GOP? Who's shining there?
So one thought on Scott Walker before we move on, which is that I think that there are a few senators in this potential field, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, who like to use that perch as trying to demonstrate strength on foreign policy. And so it puts governors in a tough spot. But the way that Scott Walker responded, basically comparing peaceable protesters in his own state, his own constituents, because he's still governor, to terrorists, I don't think that that's acceptable or right. And I think that he's probably going to have some issues at home based on that. But based on what we saw yesterday in terms of response to different members at CPAC, Ted Cruz went over really well. I mean, this is a crowd that really loves to hear what it wants to hear, which is what Jack was referring to earlier. When you say that we should shut down the government at any cost or shut down these sorts of priorities or go after the president, all of those things really play well with that crowd. But one of the other interesting things is that CPAC is sort of viewed as an organization that chooses favorites even before speakers begin. So a lot of the prospective presidential candidates had to do Q&As after their speeches this year. And Sean Hannity was the chosen person to do many of the Q&As. And I think the strength of his questions to certain candidates really reflected CPAC's feelings on them. So, for example, his questions to Ted Cruz, I think, were much easier than to someone else like Scott Walker. I think that it's a very early test, but the dynamic that was outlined previously about whether Republican candidates go too conservative in the primary to win a general election, that's something that's going to be tested, and it's going to be especially tested on issues like immigration. Marco Rubio, who was one of the eight people who co-sponsored the bipartisan Senate bill that failed to get a vote in the House, he sort of walked back on immigration, is taking a hard line on this DHS bill, whereas I think Jeb Bush is being a bit more hawkish on our need for reform. And you have those dichotomous choices, and we'll see how that plays out in a primary. But this is just the beginning.
Here's Ted Cruz yesterday at CPAC, warning against those squishy moderates. Maybe he's talking about Jeb Bush for this crowd.
There are lots of terrific candidates. 2016 looks like it's going to be a crowded race. How do we differentiate? Well, we all know that in a campaign, every candidate comes up and tells you, I'm the most conservative guy that's ever lived. That's just what they say. I'm pretty confident you haven't seen any speakers come up here yet and say, actually, I'm a squishy moderate who stands for nothing.
Ted Cruz and Red Meat for a Red Meat crowd there at CPAC. Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Sam. You're on the air.
Hey, it's the rare occasion that I get to celebrate something that happened that our government did, but I'm just head over heels excited about what the FCC is doing in regards to the Internet. And I think the key here, and I'd like to hear the guest's view on this, is that it's really taking a look at what I think is an antitrust issue. Here in Massachusetts, if you want Internet, you either go to the one company or the other company. They charge the exact same thing, and it's prohibitive. I mean, if you're not an upper or middle class person, you do not get Internet service.
And I think it's important that the internet be considered a utility.
You're supporting so that the so-called net neutrality that they're aiming for here with classifying it as utility and treating it that way. Sam, I appreciate your call. Here's a little tape of FCC Chair Tom Wheeler speaking about this with the vote yesterday saying yes to net neutrality. FCC made it so.
The action that we take today is an irrefutable reflection of the principle that no one, whether government or corporate, should control the free and open access to the internet.
Victory for the net neutrality supporters. Meredith Shiner, does that stand if there's a change in the White House of party in 2016? I heard a lot of Republicans saying this week, we don't like this. If we get the White House back, we will turn that right around.
I think that when we talk about some of these major policy issues and being implemented in this administration, I think it's always harder to change something once it's already the rule. So Republicans are really pushing back on this. But I wonder if some of that pushback is just based on the fact that there's a Democratic president and this was his decision versus the actual policy overall. One of the things that's really interesting about this debate is that, you know, if they didn't pursue the course that the president has outlined or that they decided to go with this week, it would really put a lot of power in the hands of cable companies. Members of Congress are people who never have to deal with Comcast customer service or Time Warner, for example, because how it works in Washington is if you're an elected member, you have a lobbyist who will deal with all those concerns for you. So some of the everyday...
That's pretty sweet. I didn't know
yeah,
that.
It's a great deal. So everyday issues that real Americans have, sometimes on particularly on these sorts of things...
Will they come over and explain really my remote control? Control to me so I can figure out all those buttons?
Wouldn't that be great? I think that that's something that might actually happen for some of these members. No, so, I think that once this gets pursued, it'll be much harder for Republicans to turn back on it.
David Ignatius, are you buying Bill O'Reilly's take on his Falklands wartime experience there? Brian Williams is out. Fox has him in.
Well, if the Falklands War took place in Buenos Aires, O'Reilly's got this argument won, but I don't think that's the way the history books show it. What's fascinating is that he isn't giving an inch. It's sort of classic Fox News against the world. You wonder if he isn't getting even more viewers, the more articles that are written criticizing his account of what happened.
What a world. Williams gone, Bill O'Reilly right there. David Ignatius with the Washington Post. Thank you so much for being with us today, David.
That was great to be with you. Thanks.
Meredith Shiner at Yahoo News. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty. Great to have you right here. Thank you very much, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.